Am I on? My name is Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the 43rd Bistro, no, sorry, the 3rd Bistro Banter, 3rd consecutive Sunday of Bistro Banter. This one, of course, reflective of the theme of this weekend's discussions, dealing with Einstein, the man. And I am very pleased to have with me three of our illustrious speakers who gave such wonderful lectures during the course of this weekend, and in David's case, even before that. Robert Schulman, to my far right, is presently a professor of history visiting California Institute of Technology and former director of the Einstein Papers Project. To my immediate right is David Rowe, professor of history of mathematics and natural sciences at Johannes Gutenberg University in Mainz. And to my left is John Dawson, professor of mathematics at Penn State University. So I'd like to wish them all a very emphatic welcome. For those of you who are not here every Sunday, I'd like to describe the format of Bistro Banter. It is an informal format. It involves, for the first half hour or thereabouts, questions between myself and our guests, with some of the guests who are not direct respondents having the opportunity to jump in and banter, as the name would suggest. And after that, we will take specific questions from the audience. And following the Bistro Banter, there will also be an informal session when we can all talk informally amongst ourselves. So please stay around for that. Also, as you may have noticed, this is an emphatic evidence of the informal nature of Bistro Banter, namely that we're all drinking wine. We encourage you all to eat and drink to your heart's content. There are waiters that will come around and come through and thus set the tone. And as I mentioned last week, you will find, at least it's certainly been my experience, that the quality of the conversation increases directly proportionally to the amount of wine imbibed. Let me begin by asking a question that's directed to Robert to start with, but it is really for all panelists. Robert, you mentioned in your first talk that Einstein's moral position could be summed up, or a theme of the talk was, only someone who is truly independent can remain free enough to act morally. And you highlighted the juxtaposition between Einstein's desire for independence, his desire for the opportunity to reflect, his solitary lifestyle and so forth, and his willingness to engage in the world and take various moral positions that we've heard. And David, in your talk just now, you mentioned that part of Einstein's philosophy could be summed up as don't moralize, act. And I would ask, starting with you, Robert, first of all, does that provide a source of conflict? And is it really, as a questioner asked, well, did Einstein really act? I mean, he wrote many different things. Did he really put himself out there? Could he not be assailed perhaps of being somewhat hypocritical, or at least preaching from the corner without having to put his own name on the line? We know that he was offered the presidency of Israel, and you mentioned that not only did he turn that down, but Ben-Gurion was arguably quite pleased that he turned that down. But he had several opportunities to take a more active role and really put himself out there, I suppose it could be argued. And is that really the case? Did he do that? Was he consistent? And did he put his money where his mouth was?
Is this working?
Yeah.
You've touched, unfortunately, I haven't had enough wine now to do. You've touched on an inconsistency that doesn't trouble, but gives pause to everybody. And I mean, in that sense, I think the Einstein problem of resolving this is a human one, and it is one that every individual has to make for himself. Every individual will perhaps come to a slightly different conclusion than another. But you've touched on it, Howard, completely or very much to the point, because as I tried to point out in the talk, there is a sense of isolation that Einstein protected for the rest of his life. Initially, of course, it was forced upon him, and then it really was part of his persona, though, not to really engage. We see that in his personal life, that he, in that famous statement where he said, "I have never really belonged to any country, to any family, to any individual." On the other hand, he felt, and I think there, the Jewish motive is perhaps a strong one, that it needs to be moral engagement with the world. And these are some things that he struggled with, I think, all of his life. And one thing that is redeeming, if you will, I mean, every individual has to come, as I said at the beginning, to some his own conclusion or her own conclusion in such a case. Einstein had a sense of the frailty of the human individual and was certainly prepared also to forgive himself for some of his, what you might call, hypocrisy. That may be too strong a word. The one critical thing that can be raised against Einstein is that he never really did put his position on the line. I think that is probably true. That is to say, he came after his great fame in 1920 to realize that he had an obligation the fame that had been granted to him gave him an obligation to speak out on those things that he felt strongly about. But he always felt the need to keep his distance from the world. I think that without trying to hog too much of our wine time here, I think that's. Would be my simple answer.
David, did you want to comment? And let me just add one more thing as you're reaching for your microphone. There was one thing in your talk just now that I found particularly jarring in this respect, and that was when Einstein was advocating to the people of Belgium that they should be not only that they should have a military, but that if he were a young Belgian, he would enthusiastically and cheerily, I don't remember the words exactly, but march along with the Belgian army, and that it was their opportunity to protect Europe from the scourge of Nazism and protect civilization and so forth, which are all very laudable sentiments, but certainly fly very much in the face of Einstein's own experiences. And so what is your response to this and the general question that I asked Robert before?
Am I on here?
Hold it down.
Why don't you use this?
Okay. Well, I think it is the case that that Einstein acts out in a certain sense, not as a political person, a professional political person, but as someone, a cultural figure, in very specific contexts, and his form of action as such, as opposed to moralizing and just talking, is a form of argument about how can we move forward in a certain situation. So to take the example you just raised, what do you tell young people in Belgium? He draws there on a very specific experience that he surely discussed with the king, namely World War I, when the German army went through their country. And he knows very well that the new regime in Germany poses a major threat. So his appeal at that time, I mean, it's true what you say, of course, that in his own life he decided, he didn't want to, he probably left Germany for Switzerland because he didn't want to be conscripted into the Württemberg army. He certainly had in his early life, no signs of a sentiment like the one he expresses in 1933. So how do you put these things together? Well, in my own picture of it, we have to look at Einstein's development over a course of time. You wouldn't expect a 16-year-old to necessarily think the way Einstein did in 1933 about a political course of action. So I don't see it as necessarily a problematic situation as such, these various elements. And I think his general point of view, though, is that politicians typically think in the wrong directions. They either think too small and too locally about problems, or pragmatically in their own sense of that term, which is realpolitik, you know, just very, very much negotiating about small things. And they lose sight of the larger things that can move people forward. So he did not believe in ideological systems. He didn't believe in those sorts of things that people in politics typically argue about all the time. He believed actually in the end, an educated democratic public is the only source of a secure future for humanity. And all his actions as such are then really to be understood in the only sense that would have made sense for an intellectual, namely educating the public by promoting ideas either directly or through allies whom he respected.
You got to grab the microphone, and I think just a word to our panelists: if you hold the microphone a little bit closer, it's that whole the 1/r² thing. So let me switch gears a little bit, and John, ask you a rather different question. So you spoke very well about the comparisons, both positively and the differences between Einstein and Gödel. And these were obviously very legendary figures at the Institute for Advanced Study. And my understanding is that there were several people who were at the Institute who really were wondering what were these guys talking about? Because they used to go, my understanding is they used to go back and forth to the Institute every day. And in fact, this may be apocryphal, but my recollection is, having read somewhere, that Einstein in his later years, when he was feeling disconsolate, said, well, I only go to the Institute so that I can walk with Gödel and have an opportunity to get out and talk with him. And they were, in so many ways, so very different people. And I was wondering if you could speculate on what on earth these guys were saying to one another as they were walking back and forth from home to the Institute.
Well, they certainly were very different individuals, but of course, there's often an attraction of opposites. I don't think it was simply that they shared a certain German cultural background, though undoubtedly that they did, and that certainly didn't hurt anything. I think they did converse in their native German language. But of course, Gödel was in Austria most of the time, and the culture there is not only slightly different, but Gödel had a very negative opinion in many respects of Austrian culture. There were also a number of other individuals at the Institute who would have shared the German cultural background and who, as far as we know, were not particularly close with Gödel or with Einstein. I think the bond was, first of all, one of profound intellectual respect on both parts. They were both geniuses of the highest order, and although they worked in different areas, they were both motivated by broader philosophical concerns. They both tackled really big questions and were not so interested in the more mundane follow-up work on their theories. They were both, in a sense, outsiders, and I think Einstein may even have envied Gödel's reclusiveness because it was something that was impossible for Einstein to attain. He was too famous in a way. I think Einstein was also a very compassionate person, and he recognized that Gödel was frail and needed protection in a certain sense, and so I think he befriended him partly because that he found that by approaching Gödel gently, here was a person who really was very interesting to talk to. Others have said the same thing, that if you took the trouble to get to know Gödel, he was not as intimidating as he might have appeared. So I don't think either one was intimidated by the other. They shared views, as I mentioned in my talk, for example, on causality. Both had a firm belief in causality. They both realized that their fields had, in a certain sense, left them behind. They both agreed and disagreed about politics, but of course that makes political conversation interesting when you don't agree on everything. So I think there were a number of common areas of interest. We have only Gödel's statement about what the subject matter was of their conversations, and he said that it was primarily physics, philosophy, and politics. And Gödel was certainly competent to talk about physics. Since he began as a physics major, if you look at his course of study at the University of Vienna, it looks much more like that of a physics major than a mathematics major. Indeed, a lot of his mathematics was actually gained through self-study. So he was perfectly competent to discuss technical details of relativity theory. And I think when he finally did work in the area, many mathematicians were absolutely stunned that Gödel knew something outside of mathematical logic. But indeed, he was very broadly based.
Robert.
Just make a quick comment. One thing that strikes me now that John has described so nicely the relationship between Gödel and Einstein is that there's a striking parallel to the kinds of relationships that Einstein had as a young man with this Academy Olympia that I spoke of, with individuals who were outsiders, who were not part of the mainstream, who thought unconventionally. And I think that there was a great affinity to be found there.
Indeed. Let me just ask one question, because we know about Gödel's contributions to the general theory of relativity and the irony, in fact, that that he was presenting to Einstein this solution with closed time-like curves, which I guess Einstein would have found abhorrent for his 70th birthday. But we don't have any, at least I don't have any knowledge whatsoever that Einstein felt motivated by or overwhelmed with or fascinated by Gödel's work. Is there any evidence of that at all, that he was particularly, his interest was piqued by what Gödel has done?
Well, his published comment is very brief in the volume that Schilp dedicated to him. He says that this is an interesting discovery of Gödel's, and he wonders if there won't be some physical grounds on which to reject this as not really describing the universe in which we live. But only earlier this afternoon, in conversation here in this room with my colleagues here, did I learn that Einstein apparently was well aware of the possibility that there might be closed time-like lines and was disturbed by that possibility. And it apparently asked the mathematician Cara Teodori to see if he could come up with something about that. But no one actually was able to give a proof of the consistency of these rotating universes. And so I think he was nonetheless surprised by it. I don't think Gödel really talked with Einstein much about this. I think it was a more or less accidental result of Gödel's interest in the relation between Kant and relativity theory that led unexpectedly to this result.
Let me break up, move the conversation away. I fear it may be getting a little bit too technical. So we are supposed to be talking about Einstein the man. So let me move over back to you, Robert. You also spoke earlier about Einstein and Jewishness, and how much that affected him, and how it affected his morality and his worldview. And there are two level question that I'd like to ask you based upon that. First of all, again, there seems to be an inconsistency, and I recognize that all humans are inconsistent, and Einstein's should be held to it is. But there is an inconsistency, it seems to me, with Einstein, with his natural internationalist bent and his global perspective and his sense of being not only a citizen of the world, which he enunciated, but an outsider and a loner and not part of any particular group. And at the same time, his resonance with the Jewish people, the folk, as you said, with all of the connotations that word has. And my question to you is twofold. In the first case, Do you think that Einstein recognized this inconsistency and wrestled with it? And secondly, how much do you think the virulent anti-Semitism of the day played a role in pushing him, as it were, over the edge in this particular, to have such resonance with the Jewish people? And would he, in a world such as we have today, which is not to say that anti-Semitism doesn't exist, but clearly not to the same horrific extent that it existed back in Nazi Germany, would he perhaps have taken a somewhat different tack?
Difficult questions. Don't drink too much more of that one. Certainly Einstein recognized the contradiction between internationalism and his affinity for the Jewish people. He struggles with it constantly and says it over and over again. So I guess the short answer to that is definitely he recognized that contradiction. It's the thing that he had to overcome in 1919 when he became political, and it remained a tension. And the outlines of that tension can be seen in the fact that he thought that the moral test for a Jewish state, which as I tried to point out today, was not his ideal, would be the relationship between the Arabs and the Jews. And as we know, so unfortunately, this is something that is 50 years onward still a test that neither side has met. Your other question was
with
anti-Semitism. It's clear to me, at least, and I think that one can make a good case for the fact that anti-Semitism, if you will, pushed him over the edge. Try to recapture for a moment, edge being metaphorical here. Imagine for yourself his own commentary 7 years after the fact, some years after the fact, where he says, until I came to Berlin, I didn't even know, did not think of myself as a Jew, did not really know what a Jew was. He had been, of course, in school, one of the few Jewish pupils in Munich. That was the case. That was the case in Switzerland, also both in his secondary school 1 year and at the university. But it was a matter of complete indifference to him, and it was not something with which he was not made to feel. There are discussions that he felt that anti-Semitism had been the reason that he did not get a position after he graduated in 1900. That I would dismiss immediately. You can go into some detail if you wish, but later. He also it's true that he was the only Jew in his class of five. The three mathematicians and the one woman that he then married, none of them, of course, were Jewish. But he said until he came to Berlin, he had no feeling for it at all. And it is only then, and there I made the case for the fact that it was in his, he didn't rub shoulders, because Einstein was not the type to rub shoulders. But he came into contact with, especially at the university level, he saw especially East European Jews. And I think critical is that what triggers it for him is not the anti-Semitism of the Germans, but the anti-Semitism of the German Jews against the Eastern Jews. So one of the really fine point to be made, I think, for him is the outrage that one deflects anti-Semitism intended for oneself onto the weaker. And I think this is also part of what John says with his relationship with Gödel and also with his relationship as a young man. He always felt strongly for the underdog.
Yeah, if I could just pick up on that, I think you can point to very key moments when Einstein identifies some of these things that Robert's talking about. When he goes to New York, he's interviewed, and this is published in a text called How I Became a Zionist. And in that text, he says that it was for him a tremendous eye-opener to see a free Jewish people, namely the Jews of New York. When he gets to New York, he sees a different type of the East European Jews were in a totally different situation. And here are people from the same background, maybe, but enjoying some kind of freedom that he had never seen before. He also writes in that text, and I think it's a terribly telling thing, that the entire time he was in Switzerland, he never even recognized himself as a Jew at all. He never thought of it. No one ever called it to his attention. He simply lived in Switzerland. And it was only in coming to Berlin, and apparently fairly early on, of course, he's there only months before the war breaks out, but it's in coming to Berlin that the theme of Jewishness, anti-Semitism, and so forth, that's when he first confronts that. So I think there are these very specific things, and that's a key text, I believe, too, when he writes in 1921, How I Became a Zionist.
I mean, he's identified by his friends in Switzerland when he's 15 years old. He's referred to as the Kecke Schwab, that means the cocky German. He's not referred to as the cocky Jew. He's referred to as the cocky German.
Let me change gears yet again. During your last lecture, David, there was the last question was a fairly pointed one, I thought. The last question was, you were talking about world government, and the question was, well, here we are 50 years later, and we still don't have any world government, and you put that in a much broader context, and you suggested that Einstein would do the same. But I think that touches on a point that several people have mentioned, and I've certainly thought of. Here's this individual who, after all, has achieved global prominence not for politics, not for morality, not for being a clergyman, but for being a theoretical physicist. That's his métier, that's his domain, that's where he has had international exposure and expertise, justifiably so. Could it be argued that, looked upon 50 years after his death, that in fact, while he was a well-meaning fellow, he was naive. He was not particularly astute. He may not have, you made this this wonderful euphemism where you said he wasn't dogmatic. He was very non-dogmatic politically because he believed in tactics and recognized when things wouldn't work. Well, another way to put that is, of course, that he wasn't able to see the winds of change ahead of time. And he wasn't able to recognize 10 years before the Nazis came to power that pacifism just certainly wasn't going to work. And could it be argued that he was in fact naive? And let me ask you a second question, which is, if you were to say that that's not in fact the case, what impact has Einstein's politics really had, and how much effect has his non-scientific writings really had on our society, in your view?
Well, probably the second question is a bit easier to answer quickly. I don't see. Yes, thank you. In terms of impact, I see very little, and in fact, I knew very little about Einstein's ideas in politics before I worked on this project. So this has all been new to me. And what was interesting was to see how he, in very specific situations, got active. But he does that in a certain way. It may be somewhat misleading that we're always talking about Einstein. I mean, he actually doesn't write all that much. He typically has people he talks to, maybe they interview him or whatever. These aren't long, bombastic texts or anything like that. They're very pointed arguments, usually, with clear messages. And they're messages that go to a certain audience, to a certain problem in a certain time. They're rather specific. And he doesn't do this throughout his career for fun either. I mean, he'd rather be doing physics. But so I see him really as very pragmatic that way. But the long-term fallout of this, I mean, I don't think it's an accident that I knew practically nothing in detail about Einstein's politics. Yeah, he was a pacifist or something. But, his big ideas didn't work. He was wrong about a bunch of things, at least in certain contexts. That's for sure. But the other part, was he naive? Well, of course, it makes most sense, I think, to discuss that in terms of not a sort of a sort of retrospective account of what we think of as sane politics today, but rather in the historical context in which that charge was leveled. And then when Time magazine, drags it up again and so forth, it's largely to throw in things like, well, he had these associations with communists and things like this, all this kind of bogus information, which I think is really doesn't do him justice at all. So the charge that makes most sense, if you want to talk about naivete, is when it was leveled at the time. So he comes out for world government. And the UN as a sort of kernel to mount such an effort. And when he publishes about this, he's attacked as naive by Sumner Wells, the former Undersecretary of State. And he answers Wells, I think, in a very impressive manner. That it was the quote I read, in fact, where he points out, no, we're not talking about some sort of magical formula for world government as if we're going to just get that or whatever, but this is in the given situation actually a viable thing, in that the war is over, the former allies might be in a position to take first steps in this sort of direction. And he's shot down, of course, by someone who's a very schooled politician, if you will, someone who's a professional and doesn't take Einstein seriously. Sidney Hook didn't take Einstein seriously either. He devotes a whole chapter in his autobiography to my ongoing debates with Einstein. But I think these things, in their context, I think he's not nearly as naive as people tended to make him out.
Okay, let me ask one more question to, in fact, to all of our panelists before I open up the floor to general questions. And I'm going to start citing something, John, that you mentioned in your talk, but I'm going to eventually move, I guess, over to David to start off the question because it'll be pointed more directly at him. And I'm going to start off by contrasting as you so eloquently did, the two figures of Gödel and Einstein, not in their scientific orientation, not so much in their moral philosophy, but in the starkest possible way that they were different, which is that everybody knew of Einstein and nobody knew of Gödel. And this makes me wonder, we've heard about Einstein wanting to be the loner and Einstein wanting to be independent and so forth, but to some extent, there's no question in my mind, at least, that Einstein must have coveted a certain amount of fame that came his way. And we had a very very good lecture about that David gave about how that fame came about. But in that lecture, David, so now I turn over to you. In that lecture, you mentioned a couple of people. The first gentleman, and this is why I brought the sheet, because I can never remember his name, Moskowski. And then there was Emery Reeves later on, and I'm sure there were others. But these were people who served as, to some extent, the mouthpiece of Einstein's views on a wide range of various topics. And you mentioned the concern that I can't remember who it was. Was it Pauli's wife or Felix Klein's wife or some Max Born's wife? Anyway. Had about the backlash that this might create. But the obvious question was, well, why was Einstein the friend with this guy to begin with? I mean, and why was he feeding him all this material? And clearly Einstein had was torn, or again, there was some inconsistency between his desire to be a world figure, and I think that my suspicion is, although I don't claim to be a scholar, that there's certainly ample amount of anecdotal evidence to support the fact that he was certainly interested in the adulation and the fame that came his way. And yet at the same time, he must have been torn by this. So my specific question to all of you is, how much do you think Einstein coveted this global persona? How much do you think that may have been a contrast, or if not a contradiction, with himself? And what do you think the natural ramifications of that were?
But could we maybe start with Gödel, because you brought that up very nicely, this contrast. And it came to mind when I heard your talk, too. I mean, I wondered, John, to what degree this I mean, Gödel has been described as the greatest figure in the history of logic since Aristotle. And yet, you know, here he is in this situation that you described. Has this to do with the fact that mathematical logic is really this rather new field that's kind of between philosophy and mathematics, or how would you describe it?
That's the exact sort of bantering I wanted, by the way. It took us a while to get to the bantering stage.
No, I think absolutely. Mathematical logic has been a sort of a stepchild of philosophy for a long time. In many departments today, mathematical logic is in the philosophy department rather than the mathematics department. Not really considered philosophy by many philosophers because it's too technical, and not considered mathematics for a long time because of its associations with philosophy. I think now has become, like so many other mathematical fields, somewhat inbred, and it's becoming more technical and less actually concerned with some of the philosophical aspects, which I think is unfortunate. Gödel, whatever the situation with mathematical logic and its visibility, his personality was such that he really was totally averse to public fame or really even public statements. He was a very strange individual. I think we have to say that. His personality was very unusual, almost pathological in some respects. But he worked very well in isolation. He didn't seek fame. I'm sure he appreciated recognition for his work. But I think he had such a well-developed sense, internal sense, of the importance of his work that the recognition by other people didn't matter. He didn't even attempt to defend his work from critics, and there were critics, especially for his relativity work. One major critic, the physicist Chandra Sekhar, a major figure in physics, claimed that there was a mistake in Gödel's physical work, and I think people tended to believe this for a long time. In fact, it was a simple misunderstanding that was finally cleared up by Howard Stein, who wrote to Gödel and said, Chandra Sekhar says you claim this, and did you really say this? And Gödel said, of course not. I never said that. It's just a misunderstanding. Gödel only became well known, by the way, I think through the publication of Hofstadter's book, Gödel, Escher, Bach. That's really what brought him to public attention. But still, a lot of people don't recognize him. Sometimes I wonder if maybe I've become a little too absorbed with Gödel. When my students come into my office, they see that photograph I displayed of Gödel and Einstein, and they ask if I'm the person standing next to Einstein.
Well, I just wanted to add that, I mean, that this is a contradiction in Einstein also. As with Gödel, he was completely confident of his own powers, and even when he fell away from the mainstream of physics, he didn't really care about what others thought. On the other hand, he loved to engage with reporters and play with his own fame. So, I mean, there's always this wonderful entry in his diary from 1930 when he's coming to New York for the second time, and he says he's swamped by reporters already on the ship as he's coming into New York Harbor. In fact, he has to stay on the ship for 5 nights because the crowds are so great that he doesn't dare stay the night in New York, so every night he goes back to the ship. And there he writes in his diary, he says, the reporters are all over me. They ask me incredibly foolish questions, and they are very pleased when I give them inane answers. Rough translation. But the other interesting sort of for Einstein, the man, to get the sense of contradiction that he knew in himself, and that I think maybe goes to the heart of a lot of the questions that Howard's been posing. Einstein had another close friend, a doctor named Janos Blech, another one of the infamous Hungarians that have peopled the 20th century. It's okay, I'm married to a Hungarian, so I can say that. But Janos Blech was a doctor with wonderful society credentials, and don't steal my lines here. And he, at one point, somebody said, but how can you be a friend of how can you be a friend of this Dr. Blech? And Einstein says, Blech ist ein Schwein, he's a pig, but he's my friend. And so, I mean, it's that kind of sense of irony, and in a way, I mean, that, to go back to the original question, did Einstein recognize the contradictions between internationalism and his Zionist thing? Did he recognize various other contradictions? Yes, he did. In fact, it's a famous, I don't know where he said this, but it's an aphorism that Alice Gallaprice, I'm sure, has noted, that he says, do I contradict myself? All so much the better.
Yeah. Right. Plesch, Moshkovsky, exotic people. It's part of what makes Einstein very interesting, you know, is he's open to all of these sorts of things. So Moshkovsky isn't an intimate friend, and he's not interested. In fact, the only connection with Moshkovsky is probably he enjoys Yiddish jokes. Einstein does. And they hang out a little bit, and the guy's semi-destitute. And so Einstein, being the generous guy that he is, okay, then, yeah, go ahead and write a book based on our conversations and so forth. That's all it was, really. It's not a biography. It's nothing. So what's interesting and why it's worth telling, I suppose, is when you see how Max Born's wife reacts, I mean, she really, really gets upset, partly
That German.
Well, of course. I mean, it's so clear in all of these letters, you know, that you see Einstein is attracted to certain personalities. In physics, Paul Ehrenfest. the letters between Ehrenfest and Einstein have a completely different character than all the others. In a way, you know, his friendships, even with the Borns and so forth, that's all kind of polite society. With these other people, he's just straight out, you know. And so you have to factor that in to all of these relationships. It's part of, it creates huge problems for him. He'll say stuff to people he hardly knows, and then it gets in the press or whatever. And so he has to kind of, you know, learn to deal with all of that type of thing. I would agree with you completely, though, that a couple of things. Einstein certainly enjoyed being in the limelight, no doubt about it. So he, you know, this is largely just not to be taken terribly seriously, his modesty and all this sort of thing. He likes it. His second wife, Elsa, liked it even more. And so she's pushing a lot of this stuff. And that accounts for many of these things.
There's an interesting story that's recounted in Oscar Morgenstern's diaries about the trip to Princeton. I mentioned in my talk that Morgenstern and Einstein were Gödel's witnesses for his citizenship hearing, and that they wanted to distract Gödel during the trip from what they were afraid he was going to say at the citizenship hearing, which he did in fact say at the citizenship hearing. But at any rate, one of the things that Einstein said to try and distract him, and it bears on this idea of fame, he said that autograph hunters are like cannibals, that they attempt to appropriate the spirits of those they consume. And this is obviously someone who's had plenty of autograph hunters after him. Whether Gödel found this either distracting or humorous, we don't have a record of that. But at any rate, it did not distract him sufficiently from his concerns about the contradiction in the Constitution.
Okay, thank you very much to all of our panelists. And now I'd like to open up the floor to questions from the audience. So there's a gentleman, well, right at the back, Robert.
One of the lectures I was at to put on in the last 3 years, a woman mathematician said, to go further, in my thinking, we have to get into consciousness. Roger Penrose has written a book on this. I think it's power to have a speaker on consciousness, and one of these days he will. At MIT a number of years ago, they had a conference on religion and science. Okay, so the whole area of spirituality, I think, needs to be woven in this. And if we're going to talk to suspension, we're going to talk about a theory of everything. It can't just be sort of everything in physics. We have to have a web of knowledge that we weave everything into, and we have to access this web more, and that includes perimeters.
Okay, so it falls to me as someone who sets policy for the Institute to answer that question, so I'll spare our panelists for how the Institute can be better. And I will direct you to my talk in a shameless bit of self-promotion next Saturday, where I talk about the institution and how it was created and where it's going, and I'd be very welcome to answer your questions at that point. And before I move it over, let me just add that there's in the spirit of Gödel pointing out contradictions in the American Constitution, I can point out a similar one in your comment, which is you mentioned the illustrious Roger Penrose, who mentions consciousness and that we have never had a speaker on consciousness. Well, Roger actually has given a talk as part of our public lecture series, although it wasn't about consciousness. Now, I move over here to this gentleman.
Existence of God by Gödel. And it was one of the
Well, right.
Existence of God and Goethe, and I got 13,400. Now, my question is, was that the philosophical theory that you mentioned?
I hope so.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, that's an interesting topic. The so-called ontological proof, it's a formalization in S4 modal logic of Leibniz's argument for the existence of God. It's been described by Dana Scott as a correct proof based on very strong principles. And I think that's a fair characterization of it. He never published it because he said he was afraid that if he did, people would think that he really believed in God, whereas this was actually a formal exercise. But in fact, we know that he was a believer. He said so in response to a question from a sociologist, a questionnaire that this sociologist sent him, which Gödel dutifully filled out but never returned to him, found in Gödel's Nachlass after he died. We know this from correspondence he had with his mother, where he talks about his religious beliefs. The original ontological proof is a single page. It doesn't take as much space to prove God's existence as it does the incompleteness theorem. So it's published in Gödel's collected works. You can find the ontological proof in volume 2, but it, or I'm sorry, volume 3, because it was not published during his lifetime. The commentary, the 20 pages or whatever, I think is by, you know, a secondary commentary by other people, because it's, the proof itself is totally in mathematical symbols. There's almost no words given there. And you have to be pretty sophisticated in theology, in knowing the classical arguments for the existence of God, the argument from design, the cosmological argument, and the ontological proof that Gödel is talking about, to really understand what it's all about. I think mathematicians have tended to dismiss it just because they're not really interested in the subject. But there are people who take this seriously, and there have been a number of, I think, quite good commentaries on it. Dana Scott, for one, and Howard Sobel, who I believe is here in Canada somewhere. I'm not sure where he is right now. So, yes, it's one of his works that hasn't received as much attention as some of his others.
Could I just comment on that? I think Howard was trying to ask earlier about speculation of what Gödel and Einstein talk about, and whether or not Gödel's work was of any interest to Einstein, independent of the cosmological model. I just have an anecdote to say about it. What did Einstein know about these sorts of things at all? If it's of any help, Hilbert, in 1918, shortly after Cantor dies, writes a letter to Cantor's widow about what a great figure he was in the history of mathematics and how important. And he relates that he is recently in Berlin and had the opportunity to explain Cantor's diagonal argument that you alluded to for the uncountability of the real numbers to Einstein, and that Einstein understood it completely, of course, and he was very excited by it. But, you know, the fact that Einstein wouldn't know that kind of indicates that he, with this sort of, it was very modern mathematics at that time, and he simply didn't know that sort of thing. So possibly they didn't have so much to talk about when it came to things that Gödel was a complete expert on.
Well, I suspect that Gödel actually understood the mathematics of Einstein's work much better than Einstein understood the mathematics of Gödel's work, because logic has remained outside the mainstream for so long, whereas differential geometry was, of course, absolutely essential to formulate relativity theory.
Good. Another gentleman right here with a question.
I don't see a conflict with him saying that a pacifist stand is proper, and then looking at Belgium and saying, you know, but it's not going to work here. So by the end of the Second World War, was he still talking about this idea of a world government? Because at that point, you would have seen the rise and fall of the Germany and their intent to build this sort of one world view. He would have seen the foundation of Russia, and again, this concept of unity in a large population of ununifiable people. Did he change at all, or did he get cynical towards the end about those things?
Well, I tried to lay that out in the beginning of my talk. You know, there are these periods of engagement, and one of them is probably the most serious in this line is the period from Hiroshima until the time the Soviets get the atom bomb. Once that happens, a great deal of the capital available for this type of an enterprise is lost. I mean, part of this is the hope that when the so-called free world still has a monopoly on nuclear weapons, that it's sort of in the driver's seat to try to do that, and the liberal wing of the political world was really moving, especially right after the war. There's about a two-year period when you can see people like Reeves. Reeves' book sold 80,000 copies. It was for 6 months. The number one nonfiction bestseller in the United States. It was required reading at all elite American colleges. It went through serialization and Reader's Digest. I mean, it was a phenomenon, this book. And for a short period of time, everybody was talking about this particular topic. So it's something that gets lost. Of course, our standard picture of the history of the period is the Cold War that kicks in. You know, Kennan's telegram from Moscow and the Truman Doctrine and the Berlin Airlift and all of that. Everybody knows these things. But what they don't know is that actually there was some serious momentum and they even got some legislation through to promote things that were moving along the lines that Einstein and Szilard and others, Szilard was by far the most active physicist, were hoping for. And so he becomes pessimistic. Sure, it's right. It's the McCarthy period. It's 1950, and afterward he becomes very down on what's going on politically. And at that point, all he's doing is protesting largely what's happening.
I mean, it's always a problem to view the past through the prism of more recent events. And I mean, if you realize, for instance, that in the period right after the Second World War, people like Edward Teller, who became one of the architects of Star Wars and one of President Reagan's main supports for the most fantastic schemes for raining terror on other countries. Teller was a supporter of world government after the Second World War for a brief period of time. So there was a window.
We had one more question over here. I think the gentleman in the green shirt who is very cleverly ordering another beer. was there one more question? Did you have a question? Yes, sir.
Well,
oh boy.
Well, I'll defer to my colleagues here on the with respect to the science. As far as his political, let's take it more to a more personal level. He was a student of Schopenhauer. He believed that there was a pattern that was set. And which the individual, I mean, it's difficult, of course, to get. He wasn't a philosopher, although there are those who make that argument. But it was a belief of his that the individual is, in a sense, determined to go a certain way. It has a certain theatrical character too for him as a young man. Because it serves as a nice pretext for getting out of that relationship that he had with the young girl in 1897, I am predestined, if you will, to find my destiny in the stars and not in personal relationships. Now you can take that as another example of his of a certain degree of hypocrisy. I'm not someone that would defend Einstein vigilantly against such a charge. But I think there is, in addition to that kind of theatrical effect there, where he's trying to practically get out of a situation that he would like to avoid, there is a strong sense that events are determined, yet within the confines of such a system, one must do one's best, so to speak, or to achieve as much as possible. Maybe someone else would...
Well, David's drinking, so I'm going to ask one more question, unless you'd like to ask something about, would you like to know strict determinism? Okay, so there's time for one more question, and I think it's of relevance to everything that we've been talking about. And I'd like to ask again all of our panelists to respond before we sum up. And it has to do, again, with this figure of Einstein, the man, and the impact that he has had on our society. So whether or not one believes that he was naive or not, whether one believes that his political views had impact or not, whether one believes he should merely have limited himself to the realm of science or not, one can certainly not dispute the claim that Albert Einstein is one of the most iconic figures worldwide as a scientist. And I guess the question I will ask all of you is, why do you think that is, and how much of his supplementary writings and efforts outside of science played a part in drafting that view globally of Einstein and the influence that it's had? So I'll start with you, John.
Well, I think there's perhaps a number of things that contributed to the Einstein image. First of all, simply his iconoclastic physical appearance is striking, the grandfatherly sort of appearance. His seeming openness, even toward children, and in some ways, childlike naivete, if you will, that was appealing. Of course, the spectacular results of his theories. But I think it's a combination of a lot of different factors that led to that. I think there was simply a respect for intellectualism at one time that has sadly been lost, and it was possible at that time for an intellectual figure to command great respect in a way that's hard for us to imagine now.
So I'll start with Robert second, because I know David has actually given a lecture on this, so we'll let him sum it up.
Well, I would say timing is everything. not my own, with respect to Einstein in the 20th century. He had, shall we call it the good luck or the bad luck or the luck, of arriving on the scene at a time when a number of factors came into play. I mean, and some of them I also discussed, and David also, the fact that he appears at the end of the First World War, gives certainty at a time when all values and laws of human encounter seem to have collapsed. He finds truth in eternal truth, or seems to find eternal truths. There is also the important timing of the fact that at the end of the First World War, you get really something that has only had its infancy some years before, but really becomes a major factor then, mass communication, and that's combined with mass democracy, or shall we say mass movements. So Einstein becomes then the plaything of, or the focus of, large-scale interest, obviously not television yet, but the press, which is a critical factor. In the 20s, one can't imagine events in Germany, for instance, occurring without the mass mobilization of opinion in the newspapers. So you have that fascination with him that's repeated then in the United States when he comes to visit. On one of his trips to California, he meets Charlie Chaplin for a premiere of City Lights, and everybody starts applauding him when they come in, and the anecdote runs as follows. Einstein turns to Chaplin and says, "Why are they applauding?" And Chaplin says they are plotting because they think, because they don't understand you and think they understand me. So, I mean, the inscrutability of Einstein, the fact the wise man, the 12 men that know the secrets of the universe, and no one else knows it, that's part of the charm. But to answer very briefly, so I don't cut off my colleagues here, what's most important for Einstein is to engage with the contradictions in him, which, as I tried to say at the beginning, is a contradictions that everyone has. And he is an educational model for every individual, in that putting intellect above the more, shall we say, more primitive concerns that tend to threaten to engulf our world.
And I guess I would just add to that, this iconography of Einstein, all of this imagery we associate with him today and so forth, there are waves of this. So some of our talks have been describing what happens in Weimar Germany and so forth. That's a particularly interesting place for a historian to look, but not that many people today are fascinated with Weimar Germany as such. Historians do it because that's one of the landmarks, of course, of modernity. It's really the modern world begins there, more or less. I think I said so in my talk, that this historian Paul Johnson, who writes 800 pages about the modern world, says it all began with that solar eclipse. That was the key date or something, because of the fact that these themes that are linked with Einstein and the very word relativity, relativism, and so forth, that they are actually a thread running through the whole history of the period. So there's a bunch of that sort of thing, but you have to kind of look at waves of these things. And of course, 2005 has been a year in which people have focused on and no doubt produced new images and so forth. And it's part of an ongoing process. So Einstein is, in a way, a sort of pop star figure comparable to a Marilyn Monroe in American culture. He's certainly, and all of these things are, of course, complicated cultural processes when it comes down to it, to understand how that all happens.
So with that vision of Einstein akin to Marilyn Monroe, we will leave you. And I'd like to thank all of our speakers, Robert, David, and John, for not only a very stimulating conversation this afternoon, but for their contributions this weekend, which have been very, very well received and extremely well done. Thank you all very much. So we will now commence with the informal part of